Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 173, recorded Friday, March 12th, 2021. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: what's new in travel insurance and keeping ahead of those expiring miles. Coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, on what has been really a nice week. Temps got into the 60s at the beginning of the week, so I broke out the bike for a ride along the lake. Sunny in most parts, but a bit chillier in the shady parts. Ended up riding narrow paths that were cut through 5-foot, 6-foot ice and snow mounds, which were the remnants of what were really impressive pileups of shore ice during the February deep freeze. No travel since the last episode, but heading out next week to hang out on the beach in San Diego, reloading from our January pivot away from California because of the lockdowns at that time. A couple of months on, COVID cases are down. The state's order banning hotel and Airbnb hosts from renting to out-of-staters is gone. Outdoor dining has reopened. And most importantly, the craft brewing tap rooms are open again. I pointed my little Python Untapped script. I mentioned that a couple of episodes ago. Well, I pointed it from Tucson over to San Diego, and I can see a lot of brewery check-ins. And in between those tap room visits, though, I think we'll manage to squeeze in a bit of biking and hiking and some beach walks. And like many folks, we're building our travel calendar for the rest of the year. Nashville, New York City, Northern Michigan, and Maine already written in pen for the first half of the year. We're penciling in the UK for November, booking it now to lock in no-fee cancellations that are probably going to start to end by the end of this month. But we want the no-fee cancellations in case of, say, another winter COVID spike, or I think what's probably a bit more likely is lingering resistance to dropping international quarantine requirements. But I'm optimistic, hopeful, that the US and the UK will get enough people vaccinated by then that these won't be a problem. I was on a Zoom call a couple of nights ago with a bunch of college friends. Somebody asked, "Do you think we can all get together in person in September for homecoming?" My cut at it, absolutely. We just need to lean into it. And it feels like that's what most people actually are doing, leaning into visits to physically get together with family and friends that they haven't seen for a year now. Now, it's always dangerous drawing a straight trend line, but I don't know. It kind of feels like travel might come back a bit quicker than expected. So following up, I finally pushed out the refreshed website last week. It's the first change since 2006, and I got to tell you, I've noticed that website aesthetics have changed a bit over the past sort of 15 years, and so decided I needed to catch up. Thanks to everyone who responded to my request on Facebook and Twitter to hit the new site for a bit of crowdsourced end-user testing. It's kind of a bit like the meme you'll see posted in a lot of IT shops, a picture of Dos Equis' most interesting man in the world with the line, "I don't always test my code, but when I do, I test in production." There's still some tweaks I need to make, but it seems pretty solid. Check it out if you get the chance, travelcommons.com, and drop me a line at comments@travelcommons.com if you've got any thoughts or suggestions or problems. Following up on last episode's rant about the guy living unnoticed in O'Hare for 3 months, I tweeted out an article about people living for years in airports. It's written by a history professor from the University of Dayton who researches the history of airports. Hey, you know what? Everybody's got to have their niche. The article talks about other airport residents, an Iranian refugee who lived in Paris de Gaulle Airport for 18 years, and then more recently, an Estonian guy who was transiting through Manila International Airport last March, just as the shutdown hit, and was stuck there for 100 days until the Estonian embassy could get him on a repatriation flight. I'll tell you, that one, that's brutal. I spent 3 hours in that Manila airport a few years back, and even with everything open, it felt like 2.5 hours too long. Anyhow, check out the article. There's a link in the show notes and at the top of the Twitter and Facebook feeds. It's a good read. Now, Jim McDonough hit the Facebook page responding to last episode's margarita instruction story with a bit of a bar story of his own. Jim writes, "I know how you feel about teaching the bartender how to make a margarita. We ended a week-long trip to Switzerland by staying our last night at a hotel by the Zurich airport. At dinner, we each asked for a scotch and water. They brought out this big tray with a bowl of ice cubes, a pitcher of water, a bottle of scotch, and two glasses. A crowd of hotel employees gathered to watch. Evidently, they don't do scotch and water in Zurich. When I filled the glasses with ice, they gasped. I explained that we live in a hot climate. I went ahead and added scotch and topped it off with a little bit of water. They winced when I took a sip. A cultural exchange, I guess." Well, Jim, I love you, man, but I got to tell you, I'd probably be wincing with the hotel staff. My usual scotch order is scotch and glass. But hey, you paid for it, and in Zurich, it was not going to be a small amount, I'm sure. So even if they couldn't quite figure out what you wanted, at least they gave you all the tools that you needed to do it yourself. One of my absolute favorite beer bars, Bailey's Tap Room in Portland, Oregon, has shut off their taps permanently. I started a project in downtown Portland in January 2013. I found Bailey's the second night I was there and just settled in. I was there every week. My last beer that I had there was my last night in Portland after finishing off that project. In the article, the owner says, "After reopening to limited seating after the initial shutdown, it was clear that people were not interested in coming downtown. When the PPP money ran out, I just decided to close the doors." You know, it's sad, and certainly Bailey's isn't the only place that shut down. Seen a lot of that here in Chicago. But it is another reminder that we should try to be purposeful about where we spend our discretionary dollars, thinking about what businesses we would miss if they closed out, and then go out of our way to buy something from them. Now, in my case, it helps me rationalize a rather full beer shelf, full of cans from local microbreweries in the bottom of our pantry. After Hertz declared bankruptcy at the end of last May, I predicted in episode 164 back then that I'd be paying more attention to the mileage on cars that I see in the five-star aisle, in Hertz's five-star aisle, because that's the first place I see signs of financial distress for car rental companies. A lot less 500-mile cars and a lot more 24,000-mile cars. And while 24,000 miles on a car doesn't seem like a lot, you got to remember that rental car miles are kind of like dog years. You got to multiply them by, like seven to get to the regular car miles. And true to form, when picking up our Hertz car in Phoenix at the end of January, every car I looked at had over 24,000 miles. A few had a lot more. So it'll be interesting to see what's on offer by Hertz at San Diego Airport next week. If you have any status on a Star Alliance or a One World carrier, you probably got an email from that carrier about a data breach at SITA, S-I-T-A. I got those notes from United and American saying that my name, account number, and status was potentially exposed, and that I should change my passwords, which I did right away. And then I thought about how this is yet another data leak from some unknown player in what is an incredibly fragmented travel technology tool chain. We talked about this back in November in episode 169, when some obscure Spanish company used by hotels to update information on online booking sites leaked 24 gigabytes of names, emails, credit cards, and reservation records. And in this case, if you're not in the airline industry, you probably don't know about SITA, and you don't really need to. It's an airline consortium that was started back in 1949 by 11 European airlines to share infrastructure costs, and has expanded over the subsequent years to provide all sorts of travel technology, including the exchange of passenger data between airlines. And in this case, the exchange of frequent flyer status so that, say, Lufthansa recognizes your elite status with United when you fly them. It's one thing when the breach is from a company you did business with, kind of like the Marriott hacks in 2018 and 2020, and then the 2018 breaches at both British Airways and Cathay Pacific. But it's a whole nother thing when you find that some unknown third party coughed up your data. Actually, when you look at the spaghetti that is the travel tech tool chain, and you see all the places your data is getting sent to, often small companies that can't afford state-of-the-art cybersecurity, it is kind of surprising, in a sad way, that not more of this happens. Type plane mask into the Google search bar, and one of the first five suggestions that'll show up is plane mask fight. Click through, and you get what seems to be an endless stream of news reports and cell phone videos of passengers fighting about having to wear a mask during a flight. I mean, what is, though, getting a lot less coverage is, I'm starting to hear snatches of it here and there, are people getting chewed out by their roommates when taking their masks off to eat or drink something, getting, you know, snarky comments like, hey, can you not drink during the flight? I'd rather not die for your convenience. And I got to tell you, I'm afraid this is only going to get worse as more people start traveling again and aircraft load factors, you know, head back up toward 80%. But honestly, look, both sides are just being idiots. Let's call it for what it is. You know, I mean, you know the rules before you buy your ticket, and you're reminded of them by emails before you travel, and then again by agents before you board the plane. Now, if you can't handle the rules, all the rules, not just the ones you agree with, then don't walk down the jetway. Drive. I don't know, charter a jet. But don't try to bend the rules to your own personal belief system and then hassle the rest of us who are just trying to get from point A to point B on time and with the minimum amount of heartache. Hey, and if you have any travel stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along to comments, C-O-M-M-E-N-T-S at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your comments on the Travel Commons Facebook page like Jim McDonough did, or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can post comments still. You can still post comments on our fabulous new website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is what's new in travel insurance. A little over a year ago, the first coronavirus lockdown started, and the execution of them was, to be charitable, mostly a mess. Actually, I think all of them were a mess. Borders were quickly shut, planes grounded, people were stranded in foreign countries with no way home. I mean, we just talked about the Estonian guys stuck in Manila for 100 days. And so all of a sudden, people started paying attention to travel insurance. Last May, in episode 163, as people were beginning to think about their first post-lockdown trips, we talked about the state of travel insurance. And now, with travel bookings again beginning to rise as vaccination rates rise, I want to check back in and see what's changed with travel insurance. So I asked Michael Giusti, senior writer at insurancequotes.com, to come onto the podcast and give us an update. So Michael, last May, Eric Jesowitz of insurancequotes.com was on the podcast. We were talking about travel insurance after the initial lockdown. Back then, kind of in the midst of all that travel disruption, many travelers were finding they didn't actually know what their insurance covered. They just sort of checked the box at the end of their booking process, paid some additional amount, and moved on. And then the second thing they were finding out was, is indeed that insurance that they had bought had exclusions for communicable diseases, WHO-declared pandemics, cancellations, and cases of fear. And then after that, insurers stopped offering travel insurance. So, Michael, that was May. This is now, you know, the end of February. What's the current situation regarding travel insurance?
Not many people thinking about pandemics back when this started, but the few people who were insurers. They saw the SARS epidemic and they started writing in pandemic exclusions from that point on. And then there's a second little provision in these insurance policies called the known event provisions. So once the pandemic's declared, even if there wasn't an specific exclusion, they could turn around and say, well, we're not going to cover it because it's now a known event. It would be like, you know, there's a hurricane that's bearing down on your city and you buy a plane ticket while that hurricane's there and then you get mad because you can't fly, right? Right. Well, that was a known event. And so they're not going to cover that. So that's kind of where we came from. And then you're right, they stopped and they said, we have no idea what's going on. So let's kind of regroup. And now they've regrouped. And it's really interesting because in a lot of the insurance industry, they've stopped covering pandemics. But in travel insurance, they've specifically started including COVID-19, which
Well, that's nice. Yeah, that's a nice, that helps.
They started specifically including it, saying we will cover it under these conditions.
Michael, travel requirements have been changing kind of quickly, or, you know, kind of the restrictions have been going in and out. I mean, most recently, the need to provide a negative COVID test just to be able to get on a plane. If you look at what Canada did, they basically gave travelers 1 week notice of the rule change at the end of 2020. But if you've bought a travel insurance policy when you book travel, maybe 6 weeks prior, you know, what's the best way to cover these late-breaking requirements that pop up a week or two before our trip?
Two main things. One is the policy language. So you do need to say what's specifically included, what's specifically excluded, because whether they're going to cover not having a negative test very much depends on the policy language. The other thing that it's going to come down to is whether it's out of your control. If it's something that you've neglected to do, it's never going to be covered. The policies I've reviewed, I haven't seen any that specifically kick in if you haven't got a negative test. So kind of if you're worried about that, you really do need to ask the agent or really read that fine print. I do know that if you're delayed at security while you're being tested, that's not covered. Right. So you do have to get there in time to make sure if they do a rapid test on the spot that you're going to have time to get through security.
Let me unpack that just a little bit, Michael. So I booked my flight and I've booked it a month ago. And now I go to take my test 72 hours before departure and I come up positive. Mm-hmm. If I've bought the right policy, mm-hmm. would that typically cover delay or cover cancellation?
Delay is always the first preference. So, you know, if we can just push this trip back a week or whatever, that's going to be everyone's favorite outcome. Mm-hmm. But there are cancellation provisions where that, you know, you can't move it because the wedding is not going to be moved, right? For example, in which case the cancellation provision might kick in.
So now let's flip that. So I've taken my test. It's been negative. I get on the plane. I fly down to Costa Rica. And now a week on, I've gone and I've taken my test to get back into the U.S. And now that test comes out positive. So now, potentially, I can't get back into the U.S. How does insurance help me there?
There's a couple places where this insurance is going to be really beneficial in that situation. First and foremost, the medical provision in most of these comprehensive policies are going to actually help you pay for your health care. Many of them are going to be secondary coverage, meaning they're going to want your primary health care to kick in first.
That makes sense.
And then they'll jump in and cover anything that's not covered. Some of them, though, are primary, you know, especially with the overseas trips. So, you know, that's a really nice benefit that are built into a lot of these policies. The other place it'll help is if you're delayed because, you know, you can't travel because of a restriction like that, and it's outside of your control. A lot of them will cover a, you know, hotel while you're waiting and meals while you're waiting, and they'll get you back home safely. So that's actually a really positive outcome that can happen with these policies.
So, Michael, how do I make sure that I've actually got one of those policies? If we go back to the April, May timeframe, people were finding that they didn't actually know what they had. How do I make sure I've actually bought that coverage?
Well, the best case scenario would be is if you found a human and you asked them in plain English, but
good luck with that, right?
Calling 1-800 numbers anymore. that's so much in the cards. What I would do if I was doing that, I'd click through the terms of service and see who's offering that policy. If it doesn't really go into much detail or it's really garbly legalese, go through to the provider's website. And most of them have FAQ pages that specifically address COVID. So that's going to be probably your best resources.
So, Michael, people are starting to think about big trips as kind of vaccination rates start to step up. You know, the back half of the year, if I'm thinking about booking, I don't know, say a week's biking tour in sort of Tuscany or Provence in September or October, what kind of travel insurance should I be looking for? Should I pony up for a cancel for any reason rider? Or are there maybe some cheaper alternatives for more limited scenarios like, hey, the EU still isn't letting Americans in, but that won't cover the more generic, oh, I'm afraid to travel kind of reason?
The question of if you're afraid to travel, that's never going to be covered unless you do have, like you mentioned, that cancel for any reason policy. But travel insurance is meant to cover things that are out of your control. So, you know, if it's not laid out in your policy, it's not going to be covered. So that's kind of the most expensive option. You know, you're going to pay the most for a cancel for any reason policy. That middle ground is that standard policy where you say, I'm taking a little bit of the risk on myself. I'm going to bravely travel, you know, wherever I'm allowed. The least expensive option is really kind of the DIY. And a lot of the destinations that I'm seeing, they're waiving cancellation and change fees. And so you can kind of make your DIY travel insurance by only booking places that would let you change for no fee. That's kind of the cheapest, I'm feeling brave policy. I'm feeling skittish policy is that cancel for any reason.
Super. Well, Michael Giusti, senior writer at insurancequotes.com. Michael, thank you very much for joining us. This was a great update.
All right. Thank you so much.
Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is keeping ahead of those expiring miles. Look, like most road warriors of a certain tenure, I have cards in my desk for, I don't know, some 30-odd frequent traveler programs, and those are the ones I know of. I've probably forgotten another dozen or so that I've signed up for along the way. And of those 30-some-odd programs, I've got meaningful balances, and I define meaningful as enough for at least one free flight or a free hotel night. So I've got meaningful balances on the big four U.S. carriers, a couple of European carriers, and a couple of the big hotel chains. Most of the rest are sort of random programs like Iceland Air or Air Baltic or Omni Hotels that I used for a specific trip or a project. But the reason I signed up for them is because they had some spiff, like they allowed seat selection or free Wi-Fi. And because of that, it was reason enough to put forth the effort to sign up. Now, when I was traveling every week or so, keeping those main programs active wasn't a big effort. And if I hadn't flown, say, BA for a while, I'd code maybe, I don't know, a short American Air commuter flight, something where my American status was a bit meaningless. I'd code that to my BA account to generate activity that would reset BA's expiration clock. But now, hitting the first anniversary of the first travel lockdowns, and with business travel still mostly on hold, some of those expiration cliffs are starting to become visible. Last episode, I talked about getting emails from BA in Iberia warning me of pending Avios expirations. That's their frequent flyer programs. And so, as I said, I transferred my Iberia points to my BA account. But I can't actually now tell from the BA website if that was enough activity to change the BA expiration date. So I spelunked some more through their website and found where they call out Airbnb bookings as recognized activity, as they call it, that will officially reset the 36-month expiration clock. So I booked our San Diego Airbnb through a link on BA's site. I just had to enter my BA account number before moving on to the Airbnb booking screen. It'll be interesting to see if that activity flows seamlessly into my BA account or if I'll have to chase it down through some sort of manual credit claim. I'm betting on the latter, but I'm hoping to be pleasantly surprised. But that got me cycling through all my other accounts. I wasn't worried about the U.S. carrier accounts. The trend there actually has been to do away with expiration dates. First Southwest, then Delta, most recently United. American, not surprisingly, is the knuckle dragger clinging on to what is, I think, a kind of a stingy 18-month expiration policy. But I flew them last fall to Philadelphia, so I'm fine there. But Flying Blue, the combined KLM Air France program, now that's another matter. I last flew KLM the fall of 2018, so that expiration date had to be coming up. I hit the website. It turns out that those miles are also expiring at the end of this year, and they, like BA and Iberia, have managed to make resetting the date way overly complex. First, there's quote-unquote overall extending activities, which are flights or purchases on their co-branded credit card. That activity will extend all Flying Blue miles by 2 years. Then there's another tier called partial extending activities that extends miles that, you know, you've earned through, say, hotel or car rental partners. Please note, says the website, partial extending activities do not extend the validity of miles earned from overall extending activities. Okay, then. So parsing that, I only had 500 miles from that 2018 flight that would be under overall extending activities. but I had 38,000 miles from when I had to quickly stash points from a corporate Amex account before I ended up leaving that company. So some partial activity would reset the clock on the 38,000 miles, but not the 500 miles. So, okay, fine. I set myself a reminder for December 1st to push the minimum amount, 1,000 points, for my personal Amex account, which would qualify as, I guess, partial extending activities. And as I kept going through it, I found that the expiration periods are kind of all over the place. So BA, we said, is 36 months. KLM, as well as Marriott and Hyatt, are 2 years. American is 18 months. Hilton is 15 months, which is a weird number. And IHG is the stingiest at 12. Seems like there should be a technology solution to this, right? Well, there are a few. So if you use TripIt like I do to consolidate your trip itineraries, a $49 a year upgrade to the Pro version gives you award program tracking. Now, actually, I'd used it 1 year when they upgraded me for free, probably by mistake, and it was okay, but I didn't feel like ponying up $49 of my own. Award Wallet is another popular tool, but there too, you need to upgrade to the paid version, a little cheaper at $30 a year to be able to track expirations. But beyond the costs, for these programs to work, you have to give them access to your accounts, your account numbers, your passwords. And cycling back to what I was saying at the top of the show, with the travel industry's rather poor track record on data protection, and just having had to reset my passwords on United, American, Lufthansa, BA, and Iberia because of the CETA leak, do I really want to put all my frequent traveler logins into one spot, into a small company that can be hacked? I don't know. I'm kind of thinking that a simple spreadsheet on the hard drive of my PC in my office can do the job just fine. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 173. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. And I have to tell you that the new website makes it a lot easier for people to subscribe with a drop-down menu at the top of each page, a big red subscribe button in the middle of the homepage, and then the usual set of subscribe links down at the bottom. I've actually already seen more clicks through to Apple Podcasts and Spotify than I have before. As I said earlier, I've still got some cleanup to do, fix links in the archives, optimize what is quite honestly a much heavier site with all the photos, but I think it's pretty solid right now across PCs, phones, tablets. Again, take a look at it, and if you've got any thoughts, suggestions, drop me a line. And as you'll find in all of those subscribe buttons and menus, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music. You can always ask Alexa, Siri, or Google to play Travel Commons on your smart speakers. And now across the bottom of each page, you'll find links to the Travel Commons social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you've already subscribed, how about leaving us a review at the site you subscribed at? It helps people find this podcast and kind of join our happy band of travelers. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file, comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page, on the Travel Commons Instagram site, or post them, like I said, on that fancy new website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website. I really do appreciate it. And until we talk again, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.